Tired of blogs?
Me too. Moby Lives Radio starts now. From the intergalactic headquarters of Melville House Publishing in Hoboken, New Jersey, aka the Left Bank of New York City, it's Moby Lives Radio.
Greetings, Earthlings. It's Saturday, the 27th day of January in 2006. I'm Dennis Johnson. On this week's show, we'll talk to writer William Bloom. He found himself on bestseller lists earlier this week after getting a plug from Osama bin Laden. And Navajo or Navahoax? We talked to reporter Matthew Fleischer about what he discovered when he looked into Native American writer Nas Dij. But first, here's a look at some news from the book world. Well, Republicans and Democrats in both houses of Congress this week dropped their endless acrimonious partisan wrangling to join forces in a historic, unanimous vote declaring war on James Fry. "We will not rest until he's not only dead, but really, really embarrassed," declared Republican Senate Leader Bill Frist. The unprecedented resolution also imposed stiff sanctions on Fry's publisher Nan Talese and decreed that the $5 bill will now carry a picture of Oprah Winfrey on it. Rumors that President George Bush intended to press on, not stopping with Fry, but continuing on past Fry to declare war on J.T. LeRoy, could not be confirmed by press time. For Fry, it was the capper to the worst week ever for a writer in all of recorded history. The week started with news that complaints from employees of the prestigious Hazleton Clinic, where much of James Fry's book was set, had been suppressed by Oprah Winfrey. Staffers said they'd told Winfrey's producers before she aired her first interview with Fry, back when she liked him, that many of Fry's claims were false, but they said their complaints had been ignored. 2 days later, Fry's publisher, Random House imprint Doubleday, produced two witnesses, apparently meant to refute the charges from the Hazleton staff. However, the two witnesses, one of whom refused to give his name and the other of whom was in jail, actually didn't corroborate much of Fry's story at all in an interview with the New York Times. They did, however, leave a warm, snuggly feeling about Doubleday's tactics and motives. Then Fry's new publisher, Riverhead, announced they were rethinking their recent contract with him for two new books and mega bucks. Finally, at week's end, Fry went on the Oprah Winfrey Show, where an enraged Winfrey began by apologizing to the world for having earlier said on the Larry King Show that she thought it was okay to lie in books of nonfiction. Although Winfrey did note that she only did that because her producers told her to. Then Winfrey, as they say in the hallowed halls of intellectual publishing, ripped Fry a new one by asking him repeatedly why he had lied. Why? Then she turned on publisher Talese, explaining that she had suppressed the complaints of the Hazleton staff because she trusted Talese and mega-conglomerate publisher Random House, Inc. more. Winfrey went on to ask Talese why she had believed the patently unbelievable things in Fry's book, the very book that she, Oprah Winfrey, had read and celebrated without question. Winfrey concluded the show by lambasting the entire publishing industry for not using fact-checkers, which she was careful to explain is not the same thing as ignoring your fact-checkers, like she had done with the Hazleton complaints to her producers. The New York Times, home of Jason Blair and Judith Miller, wrote a ringing editorial in concurrence the next day. And so ended one of the most heartwarming episodes in American literary history. Or did it? Elsewhere in the news, while AIDS exploiter J.T. LeRoy faded into the background, yet another major memoirist was discovered to be a fraud. Navajo writer Nas Dij, author of the 2000 memoir The Blood Runs Like a River Through My Dreams, was uncovered in an LA Weekly investigation to have been not only not a Navajo, but not someone named Nas Dij. Reporter Matthew Fleischer discovered the writer was actually a white guy from Michigan named Tim Barris, a writer of gay pornography. The writer's publishers, Houghton Mifflin and Ballantyne, have yet to say how they will react. And when Fleischer contacted Nasdij, he was told by an assistant that Nasdij was in the mountains, apparently afraid that Oprah Winfrey was going to invite him on her program. In Turkey, judges dropped all charges against novelist Orhan Pamuk, who had been charged with insulting Turkishness because he discussed the Armenian genocide in a magazine interview. No statement was issued by the court, but it was believed the justice system was embarrassed by the worldwide attention being given the popular author and afraid that Turkey's application to join the European Union would be in jeopardy if it pursued the case. The apparent fact that the Armenian genocide did in fact happen apparently had nothing at all to do with the decision. And finally, Nobel Prize-winning writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez has announced that at the age of 78, he's giving up writing. The author, whose last novel was last year's Memories of My Melancholy Whores, explained his decision, saying, "With my experience, I could write a new novel without any problems, but people would realize that my heart wasn't in it." The news meant that Garcia Marquez would not be completing his second volume of his much-lauded memoirs. And that was the really bad news from the world of memoirs this week. And that is the news for this week. I'm Dennis Johnson.
It's Saturday, January 28th, and here's a look at the week ahead in literary history. Sunday is January 29th, and that was a good day in 1737 for political essayist and author of the revolutionary pamphlets Common Sense and the Rights of Man, Thomas Paine, was born. Monday is January 30th, and that is the birthday of poet and novelist Richard Brautigan, born in Tacoma, Washington in 1935. Brautigan's best-known work, Trout Fishing in America, published in 1967, was written on a portable typewriter while sitting alongside many an American trout stream. Or so the story goes. Tuesday is January 31st, and it's the shared birthday of two tough guy writers. Pioneer of the genre the Western, novelist Zane Grey was born in 1872, and pioneer of the East Coast Western, writer and essayist Norman Mailer was born in 1923. Wednesday is February 1st, and it's the birthday of British novelist Muriel Spark, author of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, The Finishing School, and Loitering with Intent, among other novels. Spark was made a Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire in 1993. Thursday is February 2nd, and February 2nd is the birthday of the big kahuna of the modernist novel, James Joyce, born in Rathgar, Ireland, just outside of Dublin in 1882. And Friday is February 3rd. And on February 3rd in 1874, Pittsburgh novelist and native and longtime Paris resident, the avant-garde novelist and poet Gertrude Stein was born. Stein is perhaps best known for her autobiography, The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas. And finally, Saturday, February 4th, is the shared birthday of feminist and writer Betty Friedan, author of The Feminine Mystique, who was born in 1921, and the novelist Robert Coover, author of Prick Songs and Descants, among other titles, who was born in 1948. A very happy birthday to one and all. I'm Valerie Marians, and that's This Week in Literary History. I know my chicken. You got to know your chicken.
I have William Bloom on the line. He is the author of Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, which came out from Common Courage Press. Mr. Bloom, welcome to Moby Lives Radio.
Thank you. Tell me, where were you? How did you learn that you had gotten a plug from Osama bin Laden, of all people, in his most recent statement?
Osama called me and told me that they'd seen it on the internet, the news item.
Uh-huh. And were you, in short order, flooded with queries from the press about it?
It took maybe, I forget how long it took, maybe an hour or two, I forget. But I was very surprised and even shocked. But I was also amused. I mean, the whole thing, the idea is so absurd. I was also amused.
Well, what did you think of his actual statement? Did it sound to you as if he'd actually read your book?
He was quoting from something I wrote. It's in the British version of Rogue State, and I had forgotten about that at first, and so I was giving false information to the media saying that it wasn't in Rogue State, but it is. It's in the British version, not in the American version.
So the British version is different from the American version.
Right, just very slightly, but this, of course, it came out after 9/11, and I did a special foreword for the British version based on 9/11, and was that foreword which contains this quote. But the whole quote is much longer, and it's I use it a lot when I speak in public.
So he could have actually run across some copy of something you'd said at a talk.
Yeah, but it's the British version which was translated into Arabic, and so he probably read the Arabic version of the book.
Well, when you heard that this had occurred, what was your first reaction? Did it make you nervous, or what did you think?
Yeah, I guess a bit nervous, and I knew I would be challenged and questioned a lot about that. Let me tell you what has evolved in my thinking in the past week as to how I see this, okay? There were two separate elements involved here. On the one hand, there's my intense dislike for any kind of religious fundamentalism and the societies which are spawned by such fundamentalism, like the Taliban in Afghanistan. I have deep distaste for such things. On the other hand, I'm part of a movement that has the ambition to at least slow down, if not stop, the American empire from continuing doing many things which we find very painful. Speaking now of all the invasions and the bombings and the overthrow of governments and the torture and many more things. And to change this, we have to reach the American people. And to do that, we have to have access to the mass media, which we normally don't. And so I'm very glad that this happened, because it gives me access to the mass media.
Well, the quote that bin Laden cited was actually a very humanist quote. He didn't quote you saying anything particularly anti-American, simply that you felt that it was time to apologize. I'll read the quote. "I would first apologize publicly and sincerely to all the widows and orphans, the impoverished and the tortured, and all the many millions of other victims of American imperialism."
Yeah, he couldn't quote me at anything anti-American, so I'm not anti-American. I'm anti-American foreign policy. That's a very important distinction to make.
Now, what beyond giving you some access to media, what has been the other fallout? Are people being critical of you simply because this man quoted you, or what are you hearing?
I've gotten hundreds of nasty emails. Just a few of them, maybe two or three, would be called threatening, but the others are just very foul language and very stupid and crude would be the word to use, which I've gotten before this all happened, I mean, over the years, but never so much at one time. And of course, with most of the interviews I've had, especially on TV, the interviewer has been slightly hostile. I mean, I knew he didn't share my views about U.S. foreign policy, and he was probably looking to make me look bad. But people who have watched me on these programs said that I held my own very well, and that the interviewer is the one who was looking bad.
You're talking about more than one interviewer, or someone in particular? I mean, is this a common tactic?
A few like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been on CNN and MSNBC twice at least, ABC at least twice. Where else? A few other networks, and plus the BBC and a full long story in the Washington Post, and a long story in Salon.com.
Has most of that coverage? You say it felt a little hostile at the time. What's the end result? The piece I read about you in the Washington Post actually.
Oh, that wasn't hostile.
No.
I'm speaking. I said TV.
Yeah.
News and TV have been.
Yeah.
And some of the ones on radio too, right? Like I was on an AM station in Pennsylvania a few days ago. The Israeli Palestine issue came up, and I said something, and she said, this woman interviewing me, she said, "What has Israel ever done to the Palestinians?" And I said, "Have you been in a coma the past 20 years?" And there was silence for a few seconds then.
Well, it sounds like you are getting at least a chance to talk about some of your ideas in your writings. Is that the good side of what's happened here?
Yeah, well, the good side is expressing the political views of the movement that I'm part of. Yeah, that's the important thing.
And most of the reports I've seen about this story also mentioned that your book has absolutely leapt up the bestseller list, particularly Amazon bestseller list.
It's leapt up the rankings list of Amazon, which doesn't necessarily have any connection whatsoever to being a bestseller or high sales. For all I know, as few as 25 or 50 people contacting Amazon on the same day about the same book could cause that to happen.
That's so true. You've maintained a pretty high position there, though. And I'm not saying this critically. I'm observing that people seem to have responded.
Oh, I know that. I wish it did mean a bestseller, but I have, I have absolutely no guarantee or expectation even of that being the case.
Well, as a publisher, I know what you're saying, but I think it also shows a certain attention to you that was brought to this beyond the media. It's another kind of attention that has been brought to the book, and I'm wondering if that makes you feel or what that makes you feel, if it makes you feel good. Or
I can certainly use the money. I don't think money is dirty. Well, it depends on how one earns it, of course.
Now, are people asking you and coming to you about your other books as well, or are they just closing?
Well, it's mainly focusing on Rogue State, but I give out my website address whenever I can. If I can do it now, I'd like to.
Absolutely.
It's www.killinghope.org.
Now that's killinghope.org.
Right, and that site can lead a reader to each of my four books.
And this is your personal site or your publisher's site?
That's my site.
Okay. And as we mentioned earlier, this book was published by Common Courage. What's next for you in the realm of books? Have you got another one underway or
no, I don't at the moment. I have I'll be spending the next, even if the interviews stop very soon, I'll be spending the next month catching up on my emails and on sending out books. I've gotten in the mail about 30 books I have to make, 30 payments for books I have to send out, and it's all very time consuming, and I'm not, and I send out a monthly newsletter called the Anti-Empire Report, which is very time consuming, and now it'll be late this, in February.
Can people find out about that at your website?
Yeah, right. Okay. All the back issues are there, and tells you how to subscribe, and it's free.
And do you see the attention letting up any now? It's been, what, a week, 2 weeks?
Not too much. I must have had 5 interviews yesterday and 5 today. I mean, it's not too much.
Yeah.
I wish it would.
You wish it would?
Yeah.
In some ways, you're living every writer's dream, getting this kind of attention.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I'm exhausted because in the middle of this, I had to go to Ohio to give a speech which had been arranged months ago on a campus, and that took 2 days out of my whole schedule, which put all these things I mentioned even further behind. But that was very nice. It was a full house. I would never have had a full house. It's standing room only. That wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Well, an odd way to get attention, but I'm sure it's a good thing that your publisher must be very pleased, and that you're getting a chance to talk about
well,
your work.
He
so
he only wishes he had enough money to print
to
many copies. But my publisher is very small and very poor.
Right.
And
in Maine, is that correct?
In Maine, but I don't know. We aren't going to have any new copies available until the end of February,
mm-hmm.
and that I just hope that the people who have placed orders
mm-hmm.
will still want the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure they'll persist. This has certainly aroused a lot of attention. It sounds like your media is going to continue for a while. So, William Bloom, I wish you luck, and I thank you for coming on Moby Lives Radio.
Thank you very much.
Men.
In 2002, acting on a tip from a senior executive at one of the biggest conglomerate publishing houses in the world, Moby Lives, the blog, conducted a year-long survey of the New Yorker magazine, checking the table of contents each and every week to see how many of the contributors were women. As it turned out, the results were not encouraging. Less than a quarter of the magazine's contributors turned out to be women. In July, midway through the survey, editor-in-chief David Remnick was interviewed by USA Today about the survey. He promised things would get better. They didn't. On average, the contributions by women actually fell for the rest of the year. Moby Lives has decided to revisit the issue, this time checking out not just The New Yorker, but some of our other leading literary publications. The series will start this week by taking a look at The New York Review of Books.
The New York Review of Books is here. It's as most of you know, I'm a subscriber, so I get an early, special person early edition of it. This is the February 9th, 2006 edition, so it's still January, but they're ahead of the game at the New York Review of Books. They've got a new paper stock now. They're on a shiny, glossy stock. So I guess they're officially a New York slick right now. Let's go to the table of contents inside there. Looks like they got the normal amount of writers here. Let's see how many of them are women. Number one, Gary Wills. Well, he's not a woman. Sanford Schwartz is next. Allison Lurie, look at that. One out of three, 33% right off the bat. Very good, very high for them. We're continuing along. Nicholas D. Kristof is next. He's not a woman. Edward Hirsch, Henry Sigmund, Eamon Duffy, none of these are women. Timothy Garton Ash, John Leonard, Robert Cottrell, Coim Tobin, Perry Link, Kay, Anthony, Apaya, oh boy, David Cole, and 13 others. That's actually what it says here on this one byline. David Cole and 13 others. I guess the 13 others are on the article. We'll go to that in a minute. After that is Brian Urquhart and Michael Massing. So we have, let's see, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. The normal 16 places, only one of them are by a woman. But we're going to go into the magazine now to this 13 others so we can read the full byline. There's 13 more chances for a woman. So far, they're only 1 out of 16. That would be the lowest one since we started the survey three issues ago. So let's go to page 42 and see how many of those 13 are women. So let's see here. We got the okay. It's an article on the NSA spying. It's actually a letter with 13 additional signatories. Okay, not exactly a byline, but they put it in the table of contents. So let's check it out. So here are the names from those bylines: Curtis Bradley, David Cole, Walter Dellinger, Ronald Dworkin, Richard Epstein, all men so far, Philip Heyman, Harold Hongju Ko, Martin Letterman, Beth Nolan, there's a woman, William S. Sessions, oh, I remember him, Jeffrey Stone, Kathleen Sullivan, another woman, Lawrence Tribe, and William Van Alstyne. So that's two more women. So if we add all this up, that's 29 bylines. Three of them were women. That's, wow, that's barely 10%. It's just a hair over 10%. The lowest yet. Our first week on the survey, they had 12%. Second week on the survey, they had 19% of their bylines are by women. and now we have just barely 10%. You add that all up, they're averaging about 13.5% women appearing in the pages of the New York Review of Books.
We're men and friends until the end, and none of us are sissies. At night we sleep in separate beds and blow each other kisses.
And blow each other kisses. Men, men, men. It's a ship all filled with men. So throw your rubbers overboard. There's no one here but men. Amen.
I have Matthew Fleischer on the line. Matthew Fleischer is the author of a very startling cover story in the LA Weekly current issue. It's an article about the writer named Nasdish. Matthew Fleischer, am I saying his name right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, as I say in my article, that name doesn't actually exist, and neither does the word in Navajo, but he pronounces it Nasdish, as far as I know.
Well, and apparently the writer doesn't actually exist, or at least not the character claiming to be Nasdish. Can you tell me what exactly, in a nutshell, did you uncover about the writer calling himself Nasdish?
Well, essentially, Nasdish is a memoirist who's written three fairly you know, successful memoirs about, you know, his horrible time growing up on the Navajo reservation, how he was abused sexually and physically, and his mother was an alcoholic, died at age 7, and you know, his father was a white cowboy rapist, and every single horrible thing you can possibly imagine happened to this author. Mm-hmm. His son, he adopted a Navajo son who died of fetal alcohol syndrome. He adopted another Navajo son who died of AIDS-related complications, and that's what I determined, is that none of that is really true. You know, I don't know for sure about the boys. That's difficult to prove. But for the most part, his entire past was fictionalized. He was actually a writer named Tim Barris, who is his real name, was white, grew up in Michigan, middle-class family, you know, loving parents, supposedly, from what everyone said. You know, they stayed together his whole life. His mother's still alive, and you know, this guy essentially just manufactured this whole story, you know, as far as I can tell, not much of it is true.
Now, readers may recognize him. His first book, which was called The Blood Runs Like a River Through My Dreams, came out from Houghton Mifflin in 2000, and it was just a huge, seemingly overnight hit.
Yeah.
Got a rave review in the New York Times by writer Ted Conover. But it seems that one of the first clues came from the writer Sherman Alexie, who was sent an early copy. I guess they were hoping to get a blurb from him.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Sherman at the time, and still is, probably the most prominent Native American writer in the country. You know, the guy's just great, and, you know, he's great with quotes. And so, yeah, of course they would want to send something over to him, have him read it, and give him a blurb. But Sherman, after reading it, said, you know, this looks a little suspicious. You know, Sherman's obviously, his book Indian Killer was all about, you know, about white appropriation of Indian culture, Indian identity. And so he's seen this thing quite a bit before, and, you know, some warning flags were sent off.
Well, it also seemed to really, it seemed to be based on the character of Sherman Alexie in some respects, didn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Sherman's past remarkably resembled that of Nasdish's, you know, supposed son, Tommy Nothing Fancy. Tommy had these seizures as a boy, you know, from the time of, you know, he was 6 months or something like that. He began having these, you know, horrible seizures based on his supposed fetal alcohol syndrome. And Sherman had I don't know how to pronounce the disease he had, actually, right off the bat. But, you know, Sherman had a comparable disease that, or he, you know, had these horrible seizures throughout his childhood, you know, had a similar problems, you know, growing up on the reservation, and Sherman just said, "Wait, this sounds an awful lot like me." And not only his story, but you know, the cadence, the style, everything kind of that was going on with Nasdish in the story, you know, struck a chord with Sherman, and you know, he definitely, warning flags were set off early, but based on that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, as you went along, you report in your story that you started noticing that there were other similarities to Native American writers beyond Alexie, even. Can you tell us about some of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, especially Michael Doris's The Broken Cord. That's his memoir about adopting several made the Alaskan children with fetal alcohol syndrome and the struggles with his then wife. He's since deceased. His struggles with his then wife Louise Erdrich. Mm-hmm. You know, to raise these boys and girls, I believe. You know, with fetal alcohol syndrome, and the perils were remarkable. You know, Nazdish had this boy. It drove his marriage apart. His wife couldn't take it. You know, especially with that book, you know, the perils were just striking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, beyond the parallels to other Native American writers, both in the writing and in the character of the writer, what broke the story for you? How did you find out that it was truly a fraud?
Well, I'd say this investigation was really, you know, a remarkable demonstration of the powers of the internet, because, you know, I had a tip, obviously. Someone helped me, pointed me in the right direction. I can't really say, you know, who, but I was in debt of gratitude. But there's the book browse site. There's this book reviewing online site which reviewed The Boy and the Dog Are Sleeping, and there was a review on there which essentially said, you know, this guy Nazdish is full of garbage. You know, this is a fiction. I'm related to this guy. His ancestry dates back to the 1700s. You know, people should be vetting this stuff, or it should be labeled as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, taken on its own, that kind of review, you know, there's crazy postings all over the place on the internet. That doesn't carry much credence. But
this person claimed to be related to the writer.
Yeah, this woman claimed to be related to the writer. So obviously, you know, it's something to look into. So, you know, if you Google Batwoman's name in conjunction, you know, essentially I just, you know, every single possible permutation of her name and whatever I knew about Nazdish, you know, eventually turned up a genealogical site that she hosted, which is, you know, which was comprehensive. And the first name that appeared was Timothy Patrick Barris. And Timothy Patrick Barris had a wife named Tia Giovanni, which happens to be Nazdish's wife's name. He had a daughter named Cree, who happens to be, you know, Nazdish's daughter's name. He was born in 1950, which happens to be the same day as, you know, the same year Nazdish was born. And, you know, just the parallels kept on spinning off from there between this guy, Timothy Patrick Barris, and Nazdish. And so from then on, it was just, well, who was Tim Barris? And, you know, and as it turned out, he was a former writer of sadomasochistic literature, you know, gay erotica as well. And,
he wrote gay erotica books?
Yeah, books. Mm-hmm. Stories, what you name it. He had a book called The Mind Shaft, which is his first book, you know, fairly popular. But he wrote this book called Anywhere, Anywhere, which was a, you know, a story of his time in Vietnam and the gay experience in Vietnam, which, as it turned out, was most likely not true. You know, according to his former brother-in-law, you know, Barris never served. According to, you know, a lot of his old acquaintances, Barris never served in the military, but. But you know, he wrote this you know, novel about his supposed experience in Vietnam. So, you know, there were warning signs of this with this Barris guy. They kind of resembled, you know, his irregularities highly resembled Nazdish. And so the story just went off from there.
Mm-hmm. What happened when you tried to contact Tim Barris / Nazdish?
Well, he has no phone number. He's difficult to reach, so I had to email him. And I essentially said,
"You emailed him. How did you get his email?"
He has a blog, you know, which is now he's since taken offline. But you know, he had this long, sprawling, rambling blog that would always, you know, he'd just post, you know, 5,000 words about how he hated publishers and whatnot. And so
He took this offline in response to your investigation.
In response to after I contacted him, you know, almost immediately after contacting him, you know, based on the email address on his blog, he took the site down, or someone took the site down. But it's interesting. No one claiming to be Nazdish ever wrote me back. Someone claimed by the name of Mike Willis, and I, you know, you can almost see my air quotations when I'm saying that, wrote me back. You know, Mike Willis said that Nazdish was unavailable. He was in the mountains, you know. I forget what he was doing in the mountains with some native people in Mexico. He was, you know, going to be gone for months and, you know, difficult to find, you know, something like that. But remarkably, after speaking to Willis, the website went down, and Tina Giovanni, Nazdish's wife, who also hosts a website, all references to Nazdish's daughter Cree were, you know, miraculously removed from the site. you know, within hours of speaking with this Mike Willis. So mm-hmm. either Mr. Willis, you know, had a remarkable knowledge of the life of, you know, the actual life of Nas Deej and Tim Barris, or, you know, as I suspect, Mike Willis was most likely Nas Deej himself.
We're back to those air quotes.
Yeah.
Now, have you heard from the publisher? In this case, I know his first book was Houghton Mifflin. His other two books, let's see, we've got The Boy and the Dog Are Sleeping, was Ballantine,
exactly.
And Geronimo's Bones, which came out in 2004, another memoir, was also Ballantine. Have you heard from either of his publishers?
I personally have not, and I don't believe The Weekly has either. You mm-hmm. know, I spoke with Nas Deej's first editor, Anton Mueller, before the piece came out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some quotes in the piece.
Right.
In terms of he said he didn't know anything, but as I say in the piece, Sherman Alexie sat him down before and said, you know, there might be some problems. But Sherman alleged plagiarism, which, you know, is tough, and so I see his point, you know. Mm-hmm. Plagiarism is an odd claim, as Mr. Mueller described it.
Well, you also described the Ted Conover, who wrote the review for the New York Times book review of the book, having second thoughts afterwards, and he also contacted Mueller, the editor at Houghton Mifflin, but didn't get a response.
He did, and you know, I think that definitely set off some warning flags mm-hmm. with Mr. Mueller. Mm-hmm. You know, as I quote him in the piece, he said, "As you know, we don't fact check books." So, mm-hmm. you know, I guess, you know, there's according to him, essentially, the responsibility for the veracity of a work is upon the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if the writer's going to be disingenuous, then disingenuous work is going to get published.
This is a topic of the moment, isn't it? We're talking the day after the Oprah Winfrey show that featured Nan Talese and James Fry, the talk mm-hmm. in New York City today, or at least the publishing community. We've got a case with some obvious similarities to these two prominent instances of literary fraud lately. We've got the J.T. Leroy, which the New York Times has uncovered, and other people have concurred on this, doesn't exist, is a made-up character. And we've got the James Fry story. James Fry does exist, although today I'm sure he wishes he didn't, because his story was fraudulent. What is the overlap with this story? We've got a made-up writer and a made-up story.
Yeah, I mean, the parallels are obvious. I'd say the parallels between J.T. Leroy and Nas Deej are certainly there, and that, you know, it seems like the majority of their story was made up. I don't know with Fry, you know, who knows with Fry. Maybe mm-hmm. more will come out as the story unfolds. But what I think is interesting is that sets this story apart is really the long history of Native American appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a different tangent involved with this because it's just been rampant. You know, white writers have been impersonating Native Americans for over 100 years, dating back to Gray Owl, and whose real name was Archie Bellany, this would have been the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, you know, a lot of people are seeing this as a, you know, the third in a series of fake memoirs, but actually this is, you know, maybe the 20th in the series of long fake memoirs dating, you know, regarding Native Americans dating back for hundreds of years. So that's really the parallel I see. And what, you know, really intrigued me about the story was, you know, its history. And Native Americans aren't happy about it. They don't like, you know, being made, being parodied and being made a mockery of by, you know, by white writers that just want to exploit their culture for, you know, financial gain or for whatever their motivations
mm-hmm,
are.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were some of the, besides Sherman Alexie, you know, you're right, the other two stories we've been talking about, Fry and Leroy, don't include any instances of plagiarism or appropriation like that. Who were some of the writers that Nas Deej was clearly leaning on besides Sherman Alexie?
Well, in terms of borrowing from,
mm-hmm.
I would say, again, obviously Michael Doris probably most prominently.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Silko heard some of her descriptions of Gallup, New Mexico, which is where Nas Deej claimed to have, you know, had some rough and tumble times.
Mm-hmm.
But also non-native writers too. Lars Einar, Einar's book Travel with Lisbeth. He has a chapter called on dumpster diving, where, you know, he's essentially homeless and wandering around with his dog
mm-hmm.
Lisbeth. Nas Deej in his book
mm-hmm.
Blood Runs like it was from my dreams, has a book chapter called On Being Homeless, where he's homeless with his dog, and, you know, they have all these adventures together, and you know, it's never more than the phrases, I believe I say, you know.
Right.
But you know, there are elements of, you know, woven in that you can, you know, if you really read it critically, you can see, well, that makes sense. He probably got that from there, and he probably got that from there.
Right.
So it's difficult to know, you know, what is true and what isn't with him.
Well, what do you think should happen now? Do you think that the publishers should respond somehow? Should they, you know, James Frey's publishers have said at Doubleday, at least, that they are going to cease new editions of his book until they can add notes about the fraudulent claims made in the book. Do you think that Houghton Mifflin and Ballantyne should be doing something similar with Nasdish's books?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly. And I think changes need to be made in the publishing industry in general. I mean, as I forget who said it yesterday, but, you know, how difficult would it be to hire, you know, $25,000, $30,000 a year fact checker to check into these books? I mean, you know, I was a graduate student at New York University, and I was able to discover that Nasdish was not who he said he was. You know, I imagine someone paid to do that, you know, full time would be able to do the same, you know, especially given all the information and access to the writer and whatnot. And these things could be sniffed out if the motivation is there. So I guess that's really the question, whether you know, the public can provide the incentive for publishers to do that, to you know, when they say they're publishing a memoir, to make it, you know, as close to truth as it can be.
Right. Right. Well, Matthew Fleischer, I certainly advise our listeners to go to the LA Weekly website and read your story. It's a very in-depth piece. There's much to the story that we haven't discussed here in the time allotted today. The character of Nasdish himself, very dark, angry character, has had other run-ins with the publishing industry, lots of name-calling and anger there. It's a fascinating story. So I certainly advise our readers to check it out at laweekly.com. And in the meantime, thanks to you for coming on Mobilis Radio today.
Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate you allowing me to speak.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to William Bloom for coming on the program. He spoke to us from his home in Washington, D.C. Thanks, too, to reporter Matthew Fleischer of the LA Weekly, who we reached at his home in Brooklyn, New York. And while I'm doling out the thanks to the staff here. That's Andrew Steinmetz, our engineer, Kelly Burdick and Becky Kramer, our reporter/editors, and, of course, the publisher, Valerie Marians. Come back next week. We hope that all of our foreign correspondents will be back on the program then, and we hope you'll be here, too. In the meantime, don't forget, that whale is out there, man. Everybody sometimes has a bad dream.